Why does God wait?
Through broken and stammering lips, and that suits us better. If an angel spoke, as often is the case in the olden times, or was, the very presence of the angel, so bright, so glorious, frightened the beholder, and we wouldn't be able to get as much out of it. But he uses one of our fellow men with a broken life that is imperfect in every way, and a mind that's imperfect in speech, and we get more out of it that way. And then as we meditate and con it over and study it, the more it becomes a revelation of God's character to us. And so I hope this morning, as we consider this topic, why does God wait? The Bible tells us that he does wait in Isaiah the 30th chapter, after telling that he will have to punish the Jews because he has sent the prophets and he has sent them Moses, the law, and he has repeatedly told them that in quietness and confidence should be their strength, yet he said they would not listen. Therefore, because he loves them, he must punish them, he must humble them, he must teach them that their way that they have chosen is the way of trouble and loss, finally, of everything. And so in that verse in Isaiah 30, he says, therefore will the Lord wait, that he might be gracious unto you. Oh, he could be gracious as we estimate it now, but it wouldn't be a permanent thing. It would be just a temporary thing, because we see that what man's use has been of God's blessings so far is to turn them into curses, into things that create more trouble. And so the Lord is going to wait until mankind is humble enough to learn to use God's blessings as he intended they should be used, in humble appreciation and glad rejoicing to share them with others. And so we'd call your attention to the 18th chapter of Isaiah. Isaiah, the 18th chapter. And the message is in the center part of the chapter. Now when we look at the adjacent chapters, we find that this message is in the midst of a message to Egypt and to Moab and to Babylon and to various others that are given here. You see them from the previous pages, from the 12th on, and still a little further. They're called the burdens. They were really a message with weight to them, and sometimes it amounted to a doom, which is one of the translations. But it was a message that in many cases was grievous to bear because it meant trouble. Trouble because they wouldn't listen. Trouble like as the parable that our brother just brought to our attention of the prodigal son. The son wanted and was determined to have what he thought was the happiest way, but he found it wasn't the happiest way. It was the way that ended up in misery. As the proverb tells us, that there is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. And so the prodigal son found, and mankind will likewise find, in this time of trouble that is ahead of us, that the ways they have chosen were the ways which meant the loss of everything that was willing to listen to God's ways then. As Isaiah 2 and Micah 4 tell us, they will say to one another, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his path. And so the Lord tells us in Isaiah 42 that in the future, he said, I will lead the blind by a way which they knew not, and by paths that they have not known will I guide them. I will make the crooked things straight, and the rough places plain, These things will I do unto them, and not forsake them. So we see the greatness of God is shown in a great measure by that restraint, that waiting patiently until the proper time. And in this series of burdens or messages here to the various peoples and nations of the earth, we find this 18th chapter amongst the others. You remember that Paul, when he walked about Athens previous to his lecture on Mars Hill, that he observed there were many altars there, indicating they were very religious, and that he said, I saw one to an unknown God. And that God he was going to tell them about, because they didn't know very much about him. And here in the midst of all these others, the messages to lands that they did know, here was one to a land that was utterly unknown at that time, beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. I doubt if the prophet or anybody else got much out of the chapter at that time, because it was unintelligible to them. They didn't know there was anything beyond that great ocean river that surrounded or was supposed to surround all the known world. They found when they sailed their ships out very far that there were mists there, and so as thick a fog that they called it in some cases, the early name of Iceland, Ultima Thule, and the end of all things, as it were. Nothing beyond that they knew anything about, and so they were afraid they'd fall over the edge of the earth. They thought it was flat, you know. And so it was beyond the known world, something yet future, and a message sent concerning that land, which God knew of, but they had no way of learning it or imagining it in their mind. And the Lord held that land back until it was needed by the human race. The message opens with that statement, woe to the land. But in the King James Version, we feel that that is not properly the translation, but as Young puts it in his translation, ho to the land, a greeting. And there is trouble in this greeting, likewise, but there's a blessing too. And you'll find in most of the others that while the prophet Isaiah brings forth the message of trouble, that Jeremiah, in his treatment of the same nations, in around the 49th and the 50th and previous chapters, he has a burden, a punishment to give upon Moab, upon Egypt, and upon various other nations, but he says, I will bring again the captivity of Moab and these other nations in the latter days. So you see again, the Lord expresses that spirit of waiting patiently, because man is unwilling yet to listen to the Lord. By and by, in his humility and brokenheartedness and the failure and crash of all his cherished schemes of optics, he'll be willing to listen, because he can't do anything else then. There'll be no other way to turn to. And so in Jacob's trouble, you remember that the Jews, who've had confidence in their neighbors, are at least looking to them for help, and they have confidence in themselves that they'll be able to hold out, the best of them, with the Lord's help. But the Lord is going to break down that confidence in themselves and in the Gentiles, and they'll find that there's no place to turn but to the Lord. And the Lord will hearken to them then and bless them. He's longed to give them those blessings, but they couldn't use them. They couldn't be trusted with them. And so here, he's held them back. Hold to the land, he then, shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopia was the outlying farthest extension of the known world at that time. Jesus so described it when he said that the Queen of Sheba came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And a greater than Solomon is here. But that fell flat on the ears of the Jewish people. It didn't sink in. And so Ethiopia was the edge of known world, the edge of civilization at that time. And this was to a land beyond that, unknown. And the message describes the land in our day, because the principal thing with connection this nation to the rest of the world is the witness that it has been sending out to other nations. And he calls attention to it, that sendeth ambassadors. You see, messengers. And an ambassador always is entrusted with a message to give. Ambassadors by the sea, this great river of ocean that separates America from all the other continents. That sends even in vessels of bulrushes. The ships, you see, are paper, books. And the message is contained in the printed page. And it goes out in various languages to various peoples all over the earth. But it's sent, as it stated, to one nation. To one nation. That sendeth ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of bulrushes upon the waters, saying, go, ye swift messengers, to a nation. You see, not to many nations, because while this message goes through many nations, and in the languages of many peoples, there's only one here and one there that can understand it, that can receive it. And that nation is the one described by Peter when he said, ye are a chosen nation, a peculiar people, a holy nation, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And he is training us to learn those graces that he himself possesses, so that we can give that message not merely as now with stammering lips and stumbling feet and awkward hands, but with precision and beauty and glory, as he says that he saw an angel fly in the midst of heaven with the everlasting gospel to preach upon all them that dwell upon the earth. And so the truth is going to be made plain. The books will be opened. And as Isaiah 29 tells us, he says that in that day the deaf shall hear the words of the book, and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness. And the last verse of that chapter says, they that erred in spirit shall come to understanding, and they that murmured shall learn doctrine. And so the Lord has those things in mind. He's going to bless the people, but they must be humbled and their mind be willing to receive the message before they can get the blessing. And so these messengers on paper, the tracts and the books and the studies, all these things go out to the various nations of the world. And here and there, there are some, the members of that one nation of peculiar people, to whom they are really sent, and that nation benefits by them. But he describes it as a nation, a people terrible, from their beginning hitherto. He says a nation scattered and polished, and that's true. They're scattered among every other nation in the world. And they likewise are being polished by the experiences of the present time, until by and by they'll shine like jewels. In fact, in Zechariah 9 he describes them as the jewels or the stones of a crown that will be lifted up as a standard for the world by and by. That's a good study, the stones or jewels of a crown. God's crown jewels. He says they're scattered and polished, and a people terrible from their beginning hitherto. They have passed through every desirable and every imaginable experience of persecution, They've had to endure death. They've had to endure misrepresentation and destruction of everything that they possessed. And yet, the Lord has kept them and He has blessed them. Not physically, not in the temporal things so much, but in the understanding, because it is the new mind that is being created, the new mind that is being developed. By and by, when it is completed and perfected, it's going to be given a new body that's in harmony with all of God's principles and characteristics, that will carry out all the gracious intentions of the new mind. A nation meted out and trodden down. That is, all their experiences are measured out to them by the Lord, each one having a different line of experience, particularly suited to their natural traits and their situation and their characteristics. They'll give them certain trials that will develop their faith and their patience and their love of their neighbors and of God and of all those other graces of the Spirit. And the Lord knows best. He knows best what you need as trials. And so the Lord measures these out. But likewise, they are trodden down. They are counted as the offscouring of the earth. They go without the gate, bearing His reproach. And that's a good description of the nation, isn't it? Very like Peter. Very like their natural, you might say, actual experiences here on the earth, outwardly. Then he describes them still further, who lands the rivers, well, it says here, spoiled. We think that's a very poor rendering of it. The thought seems to be who'd land the rivers divide. The thought being can be taken two ways. One take it, one way is that the great river of the Mississippi does split up this great land into two sections. Another way in which it might be taken is that the River Jordan, the antitypical river of death, separates these from their inheritance. That by and by they will receive the promised land, the new condition, the rest that remaineth for the people of God. And then he says that the message asks for the attention of everybody. All ye inhabitants of the world, and ye dwellers on the earth, see ye, that is, pay attention. Listen, when he lifteth up an ensign, that is the plan of the ages, God's purposes of salvation for mankind. The flag or banner that he has given to those who love him. And he has given it to them to have it displayed in the interest and the cause of the truth. And they are displaying it. Holding it up to the attention of others and calling their attention to it. See ye, and when he lifteth up an ensign upon the mountains, the promises of the kingdom and their arrangements, and when he bloweth the trumpet, there's the seventh trumpet, and that has been blown since the harvest time began. And it will increase in volume and power and blow through all the 1,000 years. Until every one of the sons of Adam have heard and understood the message. He says, though a man be like a fool, very foolish, he shall not err therein. He'll understand it. So that if there is any departure, any erring, it will be a willful one. And then now he tells us that this message is one that the whole earth should pay attention to. Because it involves every nation and every individual. But he says the Lord is going to wait a while. For so the Lord said unto me, I will take my rest. That is, I will not interfere for a time. I will sit by as a spectator, as an onlooker, and I will let things take their course for a while. I will take my rest, I will consider in my dwelling place, and he likens it to a clear heat upon herbs, and a cloud of dew in the harvest. You see, this takes place in the harvest time. This chapter is about that time. And he says that he's going to stand aside, as it were, and let the various elements of mankind, his selfishness, his greed, his desire for power, his longing for place and reputation and so forth, and to the extent that he's misusing all these blessings that the Lord is sending. And while these blessings have come, the inventions that enable us to travel everywhere at small expense, and likewise at greater speed than ever before, and in many methods of transportation, and the increase of knowledge, the increase of invention along every line has blessed mankind, so that if they would, they could distribute the hours of labor amongst all the working people, and the workers would include from the lowest to the highest, so that all have an opportunity of working for the public good and a larger amount of the day in which to enjoy the blessings of God in the right way. But mankind don't know. They do not understand, and they will not listen. We have, ever since the First World War, an illustration of the blindness and the willfulness of mankind, even in our own country. We see the strange course that was taken in the use of these blessings and opportunities. There were men in this country and elsewhere, men of understanding, men of ability, men of clear vision. But they wouldn't listen to those. They wouldn't give them any opportunity to do the things that they saw must be done. Here was Herbert Hoover, willing to serve in the distribution of help, food, and money. No, they wouldn't let him have any part of it at all. And here was the other, Bernard Baruch up there, a man of experience and high finance, knew how, but they wouldn't listen to him either. And other voices advised and counseled, no, they wouldn't listen. They were going to have it their way. Well, they've had it. And it's gotten into a terrible mess, hasn't it? They look back, many of them, and wish they had a man again like Theodore Roosevelt and his big stick. But that's gone. Roosevelt, you know, believed in action. He was not a man of talk or of the way that they've used of giving way and hoping and praying and asking and so forth. He wouldn't kiss the Pope's toe when he traveled in Europe. He avoided Italy. He'd rather go and hunt the other kind of bulls in Africa, and did so. And so we find that those men who could help were not allowed to do so. It's the blindness that is of the Lord that brings in the destruction of the present order. And so the Lord stands aside and lets these things come and ripen to their fullness almost. Because he says, before the harvest, when the blood or the bud is perfect and the sour grape is ripening in the flower, he says that he is going to step in and destroy all the powers of evil. But he's going to let them ripen and almost get their desired control over the world and their desires, plans to be carried out. Let them almost attain it, but then he'll step in and destroy them. We see how that is described in the 14th of Zechariah, and the 5th of Micah, and the 3rd of Joel, that this judgment upon the nations will carry itself into the final battle in the land of Palestine, Jacob's trouble, and they'll be allowed to take the country, they'll be allowed to capture the city, and half the people go into captivity till it looks as though there was no hope left for the Jew. But then the Lord steps in and fights them for them through human agencies as he did in the days of old and stops it, you see, right almost in the completion of its victory. They almost have it within their grasp,
But then the Lord stops it. And why does he do that? To let mankind see what the selfishness of mankind will do when it is given free rein. When it is allowed to do what it wants and thinks is best, he lets them do it and lets them realize their result, the destruction and loss of everything. And so that mankind may receive the blessing when their hearts have been humbled. The Lord has this time set out. He knows it will not occur too soon. It will not occur too late. The Lord knows his own time best. But he says that he will bring this to destruction. He will cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks and take away and cut down the branches and cast them away. See, not merely trim the vines, not merely take off the grapes, but cut off the sprouts and everything in the vine that brings forth the fruit. Make it an utter destruction complete. And he says it will be such a terrible condition as we have had outlined yesterday, last evening. He says they shall be left together upon the fowls of the mountains and to the beasts of the earth, and the fowls shall summer upon them, and the beasts of the earth shall winter upon them. And here he points out that for a time will be allowed a period of anarchy, of darkness, wherein low religious work can be done. We understand the church will be gone then. They'll have met the Lord in the air. The Lord would have taken them to present them before the Father, and the marriage of the Lamb will take place. But during that period, darkness will indeed be like the darkness of Egypt, and anarchy will be over mankind. A period of lawlessness and trouble that is the culmination of selfishness. They shall be left unto the fowls of the mountains. That is, fowls, you remember, in Jesus' parables, represent the false religious leaders, agencies of the adversary, that take the good things and pervert them and twist them. And rob mankind of the blessings they might get out of them. He spoke of the seeds that fell by the wayside, where the ground was trodden so they couldn't sink in or say take any root, and the fowls of the air came and took them away. The false religious leaders with their various schemes and plots come and tell them that these things are just flowery ideals and they're not attainable. There's no use giving time nor thought to them. And to the beasts of the earth, that is to the selfish organizations of various sorts and kingdoms as they go to pieces. We know that in every great calamity that happens to mankind, there are always thieves and ghouls that want to fatten upon the ruin of society and the distress of other people. You see it in any great fire or any great flood, calamity. They use the police to try and regulate them and keep order there, because there are some, the ghouls of mankind, that love to eat or live upon the distress of others. There are such. And he says that for a time they'll have a glut of all that they can use. And this, you see, is a picture of the last stages of the time of trouble. And what's the reason for it? As we said before, it's because mankind won't listen. Therefore, they must see the destruction of all their pleasant things, of the great pride of their denominations and the various organizations of even good things. They'll see the ruin of all that. We can see the approach of it now. You remember in the beginning of this century, 1900, that the various religious organizations were printing in their Sunday school circulars and papers that now we have the churches, we have the money, we have the organizations. It looks favorable to the conversion of the world in the next few years. But after 1914, they said, we don't understand. We had all this opportunity, yet here we are with things being pushed back upon us. That our very organizations and our Christian work and our missionaries are being thrust back upon us. And we see that that was the case. That wherever the communists went, they cast out all the religions, because their religion is the state. Their God is the state. And anything is excusable that is done for that. They have no morals. They have no principles. They have no respect for God and a man. They're well pictured. The classes that will join them there in that chapter, second chapter of Joel and other places. But at that same time, he says, a present shall be brought unto the Lord Jehovah of hosts, of this people that were scattered and polished, a people that were terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation that has been meted out and was trodden down, whose land the rivers divided or separated. But these will be brought to the place, or the dwelling place, of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion. You see, the church is pictured there, that in this very culmination of man's woes and troubles, the church will be completed, taken to the Father, the marriage of the Lamb will take place, and then the Lord will step in with that unlimited wisdom, power, and say, peace be still. I will be exalted in the earth. And he will. We see here, as is outlaid not only in this place, but in others, the wisdom of God in that free will operation of his creatures. He has given the angel, you see, their power of choice. He has made mankind likewise an intelligent being with a likeness of mind, faculties to the Lord, and given him a dominion and freedom of choice. And yet, we see in contrast that when Satan wants you to do a thing, he tries to obsess the mind. Sometimes it's called brainwashing. To control it. But the Lord never does. He doesn't want compulsory service. He wants a free will offering. Or, as he said, it's not acceptable to him at all. An illustration of that is found in the book of Malachi, where the Lord describes the offering of some. Malachi 2:13. He says, this have ye done again, that is repeatedly, covering the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering any more, or receiveth it of goodwill at your hand. He doesn't want unwilling offerings. And he knows the mind and the heart better than we do. He wants a glad cooperation of one who realizes the cost, one who realizes the difficulties, but he likewise realizes the grandeur of the goal before him. A universe of glorious liberty, of undreamed of grandeur, of power, of thoughts, of communications, of enjoyment and pleasures everlastingly. And he's willing to endure and to wait and to suffer. And so the Lord is willing. So that the universe will be a safe place to dwell. Evil and sin can never enter again, because there's not a mind nor a heart nor an ear that would give it a moment's attention. They have learned to love righteousness for its own sake, because it is the best way, and enjoying the best things in the process of its operation, and leads to the most desirable goal. And so, dear brethren, let us share in that patient waiting. You know, as Jesus said, that these days would reveal the secrets of many hearts. You know, their minds that would want to do wrong if they dared to. As one minister put it, he said, if it were not for eternal torture, why, I'd go out and steal and do all these things if it make me any happier. Well, you see, he wasn't converted at all. He was merely scared in the behavior. So if that's all that fear accomplishes, well, we see it isn't any use at all. But love accomplishes much more. It breaks down the unwillingness, and love will do much more than the power of the sword can do. The power of the sword can compel, but when the fear is removed, they'll go back and do you mischief. But the power of love will do more than you ask, and gladly do it, and count it a privilege. And let us have that same love in our hearts. Be willing to wait. If it's 10 years, if it's 50, I don't think it will be. But whatever it is, let God have his own time and his own way. Don't begin to say in your heart, well, I might as well, like Peter said, go fishing. I might as well go back into the world and build me nice houses and nice plantations and make money and all those things. You remember the Lord said to Barak at one time those very warnings, which occupy, or rather, are very apical to our time also. A little short chapter, the 45th of Isaiah. The word that Jeremiah the prophet spake unto Barak, the son of Neriah, when he had written these words in a book at the mouth of Jeremiah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, O Barak, thou didst say, woe is me now, for the Lord hath added grief to my sorrow. I fainted in my sighing, and I find no rest. Thus shalt thou say unto him, the Lord said thus, behold, that which I have built I will break down, that which I have planted I will pluck up, even this whole land. And seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. For behold, I will bring evil upon all flesh, saith the Lord. But thy life will I give thee for a prey in all places whither thou goest. You see, we can go back, we can turn aside, as many have done. But those who endure to the end are the ones that shall share the glory with the Lord. So let us keep the truth. And while we're waiting, let us meditate and learn all we can of it from the Word of God, studying its pages and its messages, and let us make them our own and write them, as the Lord said, upon the mind, upon the table of the heart, and write them about our wrists, and tie them like an amulet about our necks, so that we'll have, as it were, them written in our minds and hearts. For there's lots of the truth to enjoy. You can, by use of the back towers and the studies, get enlightenment upon many passages that Brother Russell didn't quote. But he gave you the outline and the principles, and by using those, you find it opens up these texts of the Bible clearer and clearer, and every bit in harmony with that wonderful plan. So then, let us not seek great things for ourselves, but patiently wait with the Lord, and love his truth, and love his ways, and by we shall go in the chariot with him and share his victory. Thank you.